The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the double September-October 2020 issue. We begin today with our cover story, Robot Scientists Are Coming. A small but growing crop of machines is learning to design and carry out its own experiments. How will this change the future of research? In the beginning, there was Adam. We're not talking about the first human, but rather the first machine to fully automate the scientific process and make a discovery on its own. Adam looks nothing like a human. It resembles a big box, about the size of an office cubicle. It's equipped with robotic arms, incubators, a freezer, cameras, and other parts to help it do work. Everything it needs to conduct its research is there, including a brain to do it. The man behind the machine is Ross King, a professor of machine intelligence at Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden. He started building Adam in 2004 to study enzymes in yeast, and later created a second robot, aptly named Eve, to search for potential malaria drugs. Adam and Eve are what I call robot scientists, King says, and these types of machines, which marry artificial intelligence with robotic laboratory equipment, are getting savvier with each iteration. But what makes these robot scientists so special? Automation is becoming more common in modern-day labs, and AI can assist researchers with myriad projects. It's the combination of both automation and AI to equip machines with the ability to carry out each step of the scientific process, forming hypotheses, conducting experiments, analyzing data, and drawing conclusions, that puts these robots in a class of their own. Though formal attempts to make robots think like scientists began in the 1960s, it wasn't until the past two decades that Adam and other intelligent machines started to effectively carry out experiments from hypothesis to final report. These complex machines are still rare, but a handful of robot scientists in fields from medicine to mathematics have helped their human counterparts with new discoveries that are setting a precedent for the future of scientific research. And you might hear more about these automated researchers in the coming decade, thanks to a worldwide challenge aiming to create a robot capable of winning a Nobel Prize by 2050. Adam was designed to study the key ingredient in bread, beer, and your favorite fluffy desserts, baker's yeast. The unassuming kitchen essential is a species of single-celled fungi, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, with a structure complicated enough that it can be used as a model for human cells. Even though the last common ancestor between humans and yeast was about a billion years ago, biology is incredibly conservative, King says, so most of what's true for yeast cells is true for human cells. For decades, researchers have been studying yeast's DNA with the goal of linking each gene with its function. Some of these genes code for enzymes, proteins that speed up chemical reactions, like the breakdown of glucose. When the organism's genome was sequenced in 1996, geneticists were given a mountain of new information. But confirming a relationship between an enzyme and a gene still requires running physical tests on yeasts in the lab. It's a laborious task that King, who has a background in microbiology, envisioned could be done more efficiently by a machine. So King equipped Adam with all it would need to execute this process from start to finish. The robot was programmed with a database containing genomes for multiple organisms, information on the enzymes, and instructions for how to scan the potential matches. Adam had access to all of the lab equipment and thousands of strains of yeast it would need to actually run the tests to confirm potential matches, and knew how to read the results of the experiments and go back to the drawing board if a match was unsuccessful. In the end, Adam formulated and tested 20 hypotheses, eventually proposing 12 new gene enzyme matches. There are just not enough biologists around to do all the experiments we want to do to understand how yeast even works, King says. Robots like Adam aren't designed to take over the world, steal jobs, or make scientists obsolete. Rather, it's the opposite. A robot assistant with the savvy to think like a scientist can fill the gaps where science lacks the hands to do the work. Adam was the first machine to do both, to both form hypotheses and experimentally confirm them. But he has since been retired. King says he's planning to donate the bot to a museum. Eve is still in use, though King says the machine is dormant while he relocates it from the UK to Sweden. Eve's claim to fame was a study published in Scientific Reports in 2018, in which the bot discovered that triclosan, a common ingredient in toothpaste and soap, could be a potential treatment for malaria. The compound had been identified before as having potential to stop the growth of the malaria parasite, but researchers had difficulty identifying which enzymes in the body would be most responsive to the substance. Eve helped match the compound from a library of FDA-approved substances to an enzyme target that would respond to treatment. King says he would like to use the machine to continue research on treatments for tropical diseases. And in the meantime, he's planning another project, one to study the biochemical makeup of cells. King calls it Genesis. The ambitious project would test and perfect mathematical models that could fill the gaps in understanding of how cells work. We understand some of the basic biochemistry of cells, he says, but we can't really quantitatively predict what will happen if we do an experiment on something as simple as yeast. King's robotic duo may have been the first to successfully make automated discoveries, but the origin of modern-day robot scientists date back to nearly 60 years. Technology still had miles to go, but in 1965, researchers at Stanford University were attempting to automate the scientific process with early computers. They began to work on a project called Dendril, an AI composed of two main algorithms. The algorithms were used to identify unknown compounds through mass spectrometry data, information on the weight of atoms that can help chemists determine the structure and qualities of a compound. Dendril paved the way for the earliest expert systems, a type of AI that trains computers to think like an expert. New projects popped up in the next several decades. In 1976, there was Automated Mathematician, or AM, a program that generated new mathematical theorems. And in 1996, researchers at Wichita State University published a paper on Fahrenheit, which automated chemistry research. Employing new advances in AI to aid math-heavy fields spurred computer scientists to focus on building the brains of these robot scientists, while lab automation continued to advance as well. But both the brains and the bodies of these future robot scientists needed time and lots of human minds tinkering with them to expand into the projects that we see today. AM, while impressive in its ability to seek out patterns, generated many theorems that were deemed useless by mathematicians. And even Dendril had its shortcomings. Its search features, for example, weren't the most effective, and it had limitations on the size of problems that it could compute. The project, in its original form, no longer operates. There wasn't a group of chemists who were invested enough in the program to carry on its legacy. But a case study written by the original creators of Dendril in 1991 reported that the project had a significant impact on the burgeoning AI community, providing a window into a future where automation was common in science. Decades of increased computing power, refined algorithms, and new robotic equipment has finally led to the dawn of a new class of robot scientists. These bots are mastering new fields and learning to churn through data day and night. One of them is an MIT-based robot called the Intelligent Towing Tank. Towing tanks are a common tool in fluid dynamics and engineering research, often large enough to sail a boat through their confines. The long, skinny pools allow researchers to adjust water levels, waves, and other parameters to model how the flow of liquid changes. They can use those results to better understand friction, flow, and other elements that might act on a vessel or structure. Since towing tanks are often used to conduct experiments that try to understand complex physics, Conducting experiment after incremental experiment is a laborious task for researchers. But the Intelligent Towing Tanks robotic program can conduct that research on its own and devise its own follow-up experiments without the help of a human. So far, one of the machine's biggest challenges is getting experiments off the ground. Currently, a human researcher has to help the tank form its first hypothesis by setting initial parameters. Adam and Eve had a similar shortcoming. Each relied on their creator's expansive background in microbiology to become an expert. Specifically, the towing tank was designed to study vortex-induced vibrations, or VIVs. This area of research focuses on the forces that objects create on their underwater surroundings, with applications for the way engineers design different structures, specifically on ones subjected to high wind and waves. Like cells and genes, scientists understand the basic workings of VIVs, but the physics of how they work in different settings still leaves gaps in knowledge. George M. Karniotakis, a professor of applied mathematics at Brown University who co-authored a paper on the tank in 2019, says identifying those unknown areas and allowing the autonomous tank to explore them is how the machine helps fill in those gaps. We often view uncertainty as the enemy, he says, but here the idea is that uncertainty is our friend. The project was led by then-graduate student Dixia Fan, who was automating experiments in fluid mechanics to get work done more efficiently. So efficiently, in fact, that Fan's collaborators had trouble finding him anywhere near the lab during the day. I would go there to try to find him, but he was never in the room, Karniotakis says. But the experiments were going on. The tank pulls a carriage that can move at a sustained velocity and apply forces, such as vibration, without a human present. It also knows to pause between experiments to let the liquid settle before moving forward with the next one, to avoid cross-contamination of results. The machine worked 24 hours a day, whipping through 100,000 experiments with little supervision. Like King's Adam and Eve robots, the tank creates follow-up studies from an initial hypothesis and carries out research until the computer can draw overarching conclusions from the results. Challenging the computer to explore the unknown makes it grow more intelligent. It's as if you were to challenge yourself to get better at tennis by playing against athletes who rank higher than you. As Michael Triantafilou, a professor of ocean science and engineering at MIT, explains, they're going to push you into an area that you don't know yet. If you always play with people who are on the same level or worse than you, it's like never exploring the space of real difficulty, he says. The machine has to do the same. Its experiments need to provide a challenge where it will collect new data and find new ways to present it. The combination of robotics and artificial intelligence to carry out experiments, however, is something that Karniotakis says will likely be compatible with fields beyond his own. In other words, a robot scientist could hold a PhD in just about any subject. It just takes the right humans to build the bot. I think this paradigm will apply to any discipline, Karniotakis says. From studying a molecule to an airplane. Robot scientists aren't exactly commonplace now, but that may change in the next few decades. One project that could get more scientists up and running is setting an ambitious goal: build a machine capable of winning a Nobel Prize by 2050. The idea was originally proposed by Japanese researcher Hirokai Kitano in a 2016 report published by the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence, or AAAI. The call to action specified a need to employ AI to push the boundaries of scientific research, specifically in biomedical sciences, and eventually to the greater realm of discovery. But it wasn't until 2019 that a formal plan to turn the challenge into a global initiative started to materialize. Iodeji Coker, a science director for the Office of Naval Research Global, is at the helm. King and Kitano, along with AAAI President Yolanda Gill, are helping to lead the process. The project is still in the planning stages, but Coker says the group had a recent meeting that drew about 30 people from universities, research groups, and government agencies. Coker is hoping the new effort can grow into the same scale as the one that Kitano spearheaded in 1997, RoboCup. Nearly every year since, researchers around the globe have competed in a challenge with the ultimate goal to automate a team of humanoid robots to beat players in the FIFA World Cup by 2050. But the competition also offers a number of sub-challenges as well, such as building rescue robots and automated assistance for people in their homes. I think that the beauty of that whole initiative was the fact that they brought a community together, Coker says. They made this fun for them to learn and to explore these new challenges. Last year, RoboCup had over 3,500 participants and saw representation from 40 countries. The event has traversed two decades, igniting new advances in robotics. In a similar way, Coker wants to offer a variety of smaller challenges that will build up to the ultimate goal of automating Nobel-worthy science. He hopes the initiative will bring together experts of varying disciplines to build up and refine each aspect of an automated scientist, from its ability to navigate around a lab to the algorithms it uses to design experiments. And even if a team doesn't meet the ultimate goal, they'll still have contributed valuable data to the field, paving the way for the next researchers to make the robot scientists even smarter. We're looking from the ground up and saying, okay, what do we need to accomplish right now in terms of natural language processing, in terms of vision, in terms of perception, Coker says. Building and refining those individual skills would ultimately create a stronger, more stable template for a robot scientist to effectively communicate with a human scientist. Creating better bots starts with refining each aspect of the automation process in order to make, quite literally, a well-oiled machine. And a global challenge would attract a younger generation of researchers with a smattering of specialties, minds eager to innovate in new ways. We need an engine to drive that creativity, Coker says. It's not about going to the moon, it's about what it takes to go to the moon. The morning mind. What happens in the brain when someone you love dies, and how to overcome it with time. It was a crisp night in June, the sky bright from the light of the full moon. I stopped at a gas station to fuel up before heading to the hospital to see my father. 3 months after heart surgery, his newly replaced valve had begun driving bacteria into his brain, causing multiple strokes. He was dying. Standing at the pump, I thought about how we would never visit our new home, how we would never dance together again. I paid for my gas, got back in the car, and drove out of the gas station with the nozzle still lodged in my tank. When I stopped the car, an onlooker who watched the nozzle fly out of my car's gas tank said smugly, "You're lucky it snapped off." I was embarrassed, ashamed, and most of all, in despair. Not just because my dad was dying, but also because I was losing my mind. But now I know I was not alone. Frequently, humans who have experienced grief can recall incidents in which their brains seem to stop functioning. The problem isn't sorrow, it's a fog of confusion, disorientation, and delusions of magical thinking, writes Lisa Shulman, a neurologist at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, in a blog post for her Johns Hopkins University Press about her book, Before and After Loss, A Neurologist's Perspective on Loss, Grief, and Our Brain. The emotional trauma of loss results in serious changes in brain function that endure. Scientists are increasingly viewing the experience of a traumatic loss as a type of brain injury. The brain rewires itself, a process called neuroplasticity, in response to emotional trauma, which has profound effects on the brain, mind, and body. In her book, Shulman, whose husband died of an aggressive cancer, describes feeling like she was waking up in an unfamiliar world where all the rules were scrambled. On several occasions in the months after her husband's death, she lost track of time. Once, after running an errand, she drove to an unfamiliar place and ended up unsure of where she was or how she got there. She pulled off the highway and had to use her GPS to navigate back home. A lot of these things can happen to a neurologist. If these things can happen to a neurologist who understands brain chemistry, what hope was there for me? After a loss, the body releases hormones and chemicals reminiscent of a fight, flight, or freeze response. Each day, reminders of the loss trigger the stress and response, and ultimately remodel the brain circuitry. The pathways you relied on for most of your life take some massive but mostly temporary detours, and the brain shifts upside down, prioritizing the most primitive functions. The prefrontal cortex, the locus of decision-making and control, takes a back seat, and the limbic system, where our survival instincts operate, drives the car. In an attempt to manage overwhelming thoughts and emotions while maintaining function, the brain acts as a super filter to keep memories and emotions in a tolerable zone or obliterate them altogether. According to a 2019 study published in Social Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience, grievers minimize awareness of thoughts related to their loss. The result? Heightened anxiety and an inability to think straight. As I watched my dad transform from a brilliant mathematician who could calculate complex algorithms in his head into a childlike dependent searching for words he couldn't find, I began to feel like I was the one recovering from a stroke. I fumbled to find words for common objects like lemon or cantaloupe. There were times when I blanked on my husband's phone number and even my own. According to Helen Marlowe, professor of clinical psychology at Notre Dame de Namur University in California, that's not unusual. People who are grieving may lose their keys several times a day, forget who they're calling mid-dial, and struggle to remember good friends' names. Researchers shows that these cognitive effects are more pronounced among people with complicated grief, a condition that strikes about 10% of bereaved people and is marked by an intense yearning for the deceased. People with complicated grief experienced greater cognitive decline over a 7-year study period compared with those with a less complicated grief response, according to a 2018 study published in the American Journal of Geriatric Psychiatry. As Marlowe explains it, our brains have trouble processing the reasons for the death of a loved one, even making up explanations for it. This can lead us down a rabbit hole of what-ifs and if-onlys, particularly if we're stuck in our grief. Only over time and with intention can grief provide fertile soil for growth and transformation. My dad always seemed to me almost superhuman, all go, no quit, and was at his best when he was making people laugh. He loved pulling a good prank, even dressing up as a waiter at my wedding rehearsal dinner. Nearly 20 minutes passed before it dawned on me that the odd server delivering wine and appetizers was actually my father. He lavished his grandchildren with tickles, belly kisses, and really bad renditions of Marvin Gaye's I Heard It Through the Grapevine. Research suggests our experience of loss, whether muted or traumatic, is mediated by relationships, and the life of those relationships resides in the mind. Each of us responds to grief differently, and that response is driven by the relational patterns that we lay down early in life, as well as the intensity of the grief, says Marlowe. So even though regions of the brain might be firing and wiring the same way after loss, the way the mind reacts, the feeling experience of grief, is unique to the individual. What I hadn't fully grasped in the early days of my grieving is that the mind and the brain, while inextricably linked, are completely separate entities. Like the parts of a car engine, the two feed off of each other. That's why my amygdala, the part of the primitive limbic system, sounds an alarm when I see a grandfather playing with his grandchildren at a park. It's because the brain triggers a stress response attached to my feelings of loss. Grieving is a protective process. It's an evolutionary adaptation to help us survive in the face of emotional trauma, Shulman writes in her book. The way grief manifests, from depression to hopelessness, from dissociative symptoms to emotional pain, is just evidence of altered brain function. So, how do you heal an emotionally traumatized brain? You have to embrace the changes that are happening in the brain instead of thinking you're losing your mind, says Marlowe. As with any injury, an emotionally traumatized mind requires a period of recovery and rehabilitation. We don't return to our normal activities immediately after heart surgery, yet somehow we expect to bounce back after the mind scramble of losing a loved one. With grief, the mediator between the right and left hemispheres of the brain, the thinking and feeling parts, is impaired, explains Marlowe. The task is to integrate both, so you're not drowning in the feelings without thought as a mediator or silencing feelings in favor of rational thinking. Research suggests that you can encourage the integration of the right and left hemispheres with activities from medication to psychotherapy to massage. A 2019 study of 23 bereaved people published in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience found that participating in an 8-week mindfulness-based cognitive therapy improved the ability to execute complex mental processes, such as working memory and the ability to curb impulses. Other studies suggest that traditional cognitive behavioral therapy, which trains the brain to change thought patterns, helps foster personal growth among people who are grieving. Neuroplasticity moves in both directions, changing in response to traumatic loss, and then changing again in response to restorative experience. Shulman writes in her book, "One way to heal is to reflect on the relationship with the deceased and work to hold both the love and the pain. For some, that means wrapping themselves in a beloved t-shirt or quilt, visiting the cemetery, journaling about positive memories, or creating a photo book or a video of life with their loved one. For me, it meant stalking hummingbirds in my backyard. My dad loved to watch their tireless pursuit of happiness. In that respect, the birds were just like my dad. When they flutter around me, I can almost sense his presence." Connecting the loss with behaviors and activities helps the grieving brain integrate thoughts and feelings, says Marlowe. So if your hummingbird-seeking behaviors elicit feel-good emotions, that can put your grieving mind on a path towards healing. And now, some things you didn't know about learning. 1. You were learning before you were born. By eavesdropping on their mothers while in the womb, babies pick up the sound patterns of their native tongue. 2. After birth, infants recognize these rhythms and are more attentive to them than the sounds of other languages, prepping for eventual fluency. 3. But infants' first postnatal teachers are their mother's faces. Babies can distinguish their mothers from other women within hours of birth and discern emotion within days. 4. That ability helps Junior figure out whether a new toy is safe or a stranger is to be trusted. 5. This focus on mom has a cost, though. As a child becomes more familiar with their mother's face, faces unlike hers become more vague, especially those belonging to people of other races, an effect best countered by interracial interactions at a young age. 6. Ever learn something by rote? Before the printing press was invented, books were so rare that scholars committed vast tracts to memory, keeping passages in order by associating them with rooms in a house that they could imagine visiting during recitation. 7. The connection between verbal communication and learning runs deep. To figure out how early hominins taught each other to make stone implants, a University of California, Berkeley psychologist and a University of Liverpool archaeologist had students instruct their classmates in flint tool making. 8. They found that in comparison with verbal explanation, silent imitation just didn't cut it. 9. Which is not to say that proto-humans were using fancy turns of phrase 2.5 million years ago, but gene culture co-evolution theory holds that language may have evolved because of the advantages of verbalization during tool-making instruction. 10. Tools are a key part of wild chimpanzee learning as well. Mothers share specifically fashioned twigs with their young to teach them how to scoop up delicious termites. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.